Okay. We're now being recorded. Okay, so what I really want to talk about today is something which is obviously a very pressing issue, and something which is in the news a lot and relevant to a lot of what's going on, which is the question of just hold on one second. I want to make sure this is not something relevant to my Zoom not working. Okay. Never mind. Sorry about that. Last week, I turned on my phone after class, and I saw that many people have contacted me that things haven't been working properly. Dr. Gartner, you were one of them. So sorry about that. So I want to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Works great now.
So, and one more thing here. I'm about to mute all of you. In the past, people have complained about background noise. So I'm muting all of you, but please, please, please participate if you want to. So there is a way to unmute yourself. Howard, you look dismayed.
Dismayed is a strong word.
But this is not to cut down on talking. It's because in the past, people have been bothered by background noise. But there, it's very easy to unmute yourself. If you can't figure out how to unmute yourself, raise your hand, bang on the screen, do something, and I'll get the message. And there's also a chat box on the side for those who prefer that. So that works. That works too. Although I'm very happy for you to talk up. So with that being said, but please participate as to your heart's content. Okay, so what I want to talk about today is questions, I guess, of, in a general sense, of public, you know, some of the public health issues that we're facing today. But I'll start off with a specific issue, which is going on in New York State right now, with a little bit of an ongoing back and forth in between Governor Cuomo and our esteemed President Donald Trump. So I'm sure all of you are familiar with this, that we have Cuomo is in essence insisting that there aren't enough ventilators in the state of New York. The governor, the federal government needs to do something for them, get them some more ventilators, right? And you know that he needs something needs to be done differently, right? And that's what Cuomo is insisting. And Trump is saying, what do you mean? You've got 4,000 ventilators that we gave you, and they're sitting in a warehouse. What are you waiting for? And Cuomo is saying, well, what I'm waiting for is that the apex of this thing isn't supposed to be for another 2-3 weeks. And I'm expecting at that point in time, there are going to be 30 to 40,000 people in the state of New York who need ventilators. And you know, I can't just pull out all the stops right now. We have to hold on to them for a little while, and eventually, when things get really bad, then I'll pull those out. But in the meantime, I'm holding on to these, and we'll see what happens. So so obviously that raises a few very significant ethical issues. So the first, of course, is, well, is that the right thing to do? So you have someone who's coming into the hospital now, and there's an alleged ventilator shortage. And the state of New York is even came up with this. I think at New York Presbyterian, they came up with this controversial technique called ventilator splitting, where they kind of tried putting two people in the same ventilator. It works decent. They're not claiming it's as good as it should be, but okay, it's something. So the question is, you know, is that an appropriate thing to do? Is it appropriate to save more ventilators for later when people got really bad, but in the meantime, kind of shortchange people, not give them what they really need? Either people are not going to be on ventilators at all. People are going to be getting split ventilators. So is that a good idea? Any thoughts on the matter before we go? Any suggestions? Anyone? Anyone? I see someone has typed something into the chat box.
I'm not sure what your question is. Is it a good idea to wait until people are dying before you try to do something to help them? Or
let's say you have this option of splitting a ventilator, right? You have someone who's on a ventilator right now, right? So you've got two options. You're out of ventilators otherwise. You've got 4,000 sitting in the warehouse.
Right.
So is it a fair thing to say, well, let's wait until things get really, really bad before we can't use up all the ventilators now, because if we do, there's not going to be anything left in 2 weeks, and then everyone's going to die who's coming in then. or is it the right thing to say that, you know, okay, let's you know, kind of take it slowly, split the ventilator now, you know, if someone doesn't, you know, I'm sure there are some, I guess we would call borderline cases, someone who, if you had an empty ventilator, you would put them on one, but maybe they can manage without it. So is it right, I guess, to kind of try to wait, you know, look at the bigger picture, see what people might need at some later point in time at the potential expense of people who right now definitely need something.
This is last week's Gemara of the people, two people in the desert and the one canteen of water. So we had, is it clear cut that if one person drinks it, then the other will die? If they can split it, do they split it? So that's exactly like splitting like a ventilator. On a second, deeper level, it's now we're looking at the big picture here, and that's also like splitting. What's going to happen when the other states need massive ventilators? So you have an additional thing in here of trying to look for the future. The Gemara about the water was simply just those two people in the isolated case. So this is really on a three-dimensional chess game, trying to figure it out, but starting using that as a starting point.
Okay, so well, my father, I guess to elaborate on that point a little bit, which my father just made, which is that we mentioned in last week's class that there's a famous statement in the Talmud that if two people are wandering in the desert, right, and they've got one canteen of water, it seems like there's only enough water to get both of them to safety, right? So what do? So the Talmud records a debate. According to one opinion, split the water and hope for the best. According to the other opinion, if you're holding the canteen of water, you're first come, first serve, your own life takes precedence and you'll worry about the next guy later. So those are the two opinions which the Talmud records. And the standard opinion that I guess in normative halachic view seems to follow is that you take the if you're holding the canteen of water, it's yours to drink. And you know, you can't worry about the other guy, you have to protect your own life comes first. So now the question becomes, well, you know, I guess a way, you know, within that framework, then we can kind of reframe our question right here, right? Which is that, well, let's say you're the third party, right? You know, it's one thing a lot of what we talked about last week was in terms of your own right to self-preservation. But now we're not talking about your own right to self-preservation. Cuomo's not on a ventilator. Trump's not on a ventilator. We're talking about someone who's making a decision regarding other people. So in terms of that case in the Talmud, so imagine you find two people. You've got plenty of water for yourself, right? Now you're traveling in the desert and you find two other people and they both have no water at all. You're going to keep the water for yourself. That's not a question. Now you've got one extra canteen of water. So what do you do for them? Do you give each of them half a canteen of water? Or do you kind of decide, you know, well, I like you better, so I'll give you the canteen of water. I think you've got a better chance of survival, so I'll give you your canteen of water. When you're that third party, when it's not a question of your own life, but now it's a question of what do I do for the other people? Do you try to split your resources, help as many people as possible? Do you focus on making sure that at least one person lives? That's that question, that statement in the Talmud really helps frame the issue very well, I think.
I have a different perspective.
Okay.
If the purpose of leading a good Jewish life is to go to the afterlife and be with Hashem, then what difference does it make if I don't drink the water? Because if I led a good life, then I'm going to go to a better place anyway. So you can have the water because it's okay if I die. So that perspective tells me I shouldn't worry about living. I should definitely say it's good. I'm going to die. I'll be with Hashem sooner.
Okay, I mean, not to put ideas in anyone's head, but as Jews, why don't we encourage suicide, right? It was so great to bask in God's glory. Then what are we waiting for?
Because that's strictly prohibited. So we're not talking about suicide. What we're talking about is fighting for my life over somebody else's. So okay. Why should I be afraid to die? I'm not afraid to die. It's different than if I cause myself to die. Why would I be afraid to be with God?
Okay, so I guess the way I would see it is that
you invited me. Don't forget.
No, so Howard is raising a really important point, which is that why do we care? If it's just a question of who one person living versus the other person living, why is there an emphasis on self-preservation? And I think the way I guess there are kind of different layers that you could approach it on. One way you could say that, you know, it's true that if you're as spiritual and as a kind of close to God as Howard, then you might have that feeling. But you could suggest that God respects or acknowledges the fact that human beings are designed with a, right? God made us with an urge for self-preservation. God made all living beings with an urge for self-preservation. And you could say that in a sense, God respects that and doesn't, it's not right. It's not fair to mandate. In general, try as hard as you can to protect your own health, because God says, I value the fact that you're alive and it's important that you're alive. And it's important that you're alive. And you know, so don't do anything to harm your life or anything like that. But
if it's so important for God for us to be alive, why are we going through this pandemic now?
Okay, that
who created this virus? I didn't do it. Did anybody here do it? God must have done it.
That's a separate question of why.
It seems to be in the same genre.
Why this is happening in the first place? But for whatever reason, why this is happening. At the end of the day, God, I think on the one hand, wants as many people to live as possible. But on the other hand, he acknowledges that we have, that any individual has that, like that urge for self-preservation. And God has to mandate, has to allow each person to at least have the right. What you're asking is a separate question. Is there, if I want to be noble, do I have the right to say, I want to let you live. I want to give you the bottle of water and you live and I'll die. And you might have the right to do that if a person is that noble of spirit, but I think God acknowledges that we're human, and it would be a very imposing demand to tell a person you can't protect your own right to live. That's how I would see it, I think.
I could also give you, you know, this is the way Gemara works. You ask one question that causes 10 questions. So the other question you might ask is, God gave us this beautiful world to live on, to have this life that you say that we should enjoy, and we've crapped all over it. And this is the earth's way of saying, you know what, there's too many of you, you're destroying your home. Here's how I'm gonna clean things up. Pollution has gone way down since this pandemic. People are treating each other with more respect. And for some reason, it may seem extremely negative, because unfortunately people are suffering and dying, but at the same time, there's a positive effect to it also. Is it possible this is God's hand? And it goes back to the original question. Who are we to decide who should live and die?
I would definitely say it's God's hand. But getting back to that original question, though, I think you're right that we generally don't have the right to decide who lives and dies. And with, you know, using that point of, I guess I'll present the following dilemma, which the Talmud talks about, which kind of sets up a lot of these issues. So, the Talmud talks about a case which I'm sure, unfortunately, has happened many times over Jewish history, which is you have a group of attackers, of whoever they might be, who comes to a community, comes to a group of Jews, and says, either one of you hand yourself over, or we'll kill all of you, right? Either one person volunteered, you be the sacrificial lamb. And the idea being to kind of create a certain discord within the group itself, pretty much telling the group, you know, turn yourselves over, create a certain infighting, a certain pressure within the group itself, right? Where you're creating this dynamic where you're trying to force the group to pick out one person. You tell the group, you guys decide which person is going to be the one person to die. I'm trying to remember the name. There was this short story I remember reading in school, where it was, I think it's called The Lottery. I don't know if anyone's familiar with it. I think that it was, the basic theory was something along those lines, where the way it works is that one person each year had to be in essence killed off for the community to function. I don't remember if it was clear in this. It was like a very like Twilight Zone-ish sci-fi type of story. But I think it kind of worked like that. And it's obviously a very terrible dynamic when you give a community the decision, choose one of your own to die. and everyone else will be okay. So it's a horrible thing. It's a really horrible thing to do. And the question is, do you have a right as a community, ultimately, as horrible as it is, but is it better for a group to say, let's choose one of our own to die, because otherwise they're going to kill all of us? And there, it's not like you don't think they're bluffing. These are people who are bad, ruthless people who will kill all of you. So what do you have? Do you have the right to make that decision? Do you have the right?
That was a Nazi trick. The Nazis use that all the time.
Right. So what do you do? Do you have the right to do that? Do you have the right? Are you supposed to? Not supposed to? What do you do when that happens? So the Mishnah puts forth its opinion pretty clearly, which is that generally speaking, you do not have the right to make those types of decisions. Do not, like Howard said, we can't play God. We can't choose who has the right to live. And you know, ultimately speaking, okay, so we might kind of have to let many people die because we don't have the right to be the ones who say, we are going to be the arbiters. We are going to decide who has the right to live and who has the right to die. We just can't do it, right? So,
that's not a reality, though. I mean, when I was in the Navy and we did first aid, we had to do triage and we had to decide who was going to get the first aid and who wasn't, because you had to try and save the ones who could be saved, and the ones who couldn't, you had to let go.
So that's an excellent. So Howard is raising an excellent point, which is exactly what I wanted to get to eventually, which is triage. And you know, getting back to our starting questions, let's put that on hold for the moment. That's exactly where I want to get back to. So just you know, to kind of set up, give a little bit more background before we get to the Al.
Hi, I'm got here late. I'm sorry today.
No problem at all.
Yeah, but just on the first part there, I got here late. But why is it that you don't just split between the three canteens?
So I guess the specifics of the case, kind of just setting up the background here, are where you don't think everyone's going to make it. I've got enough. You know, you have a case where you don't think if you give both people, if you give both people the water, it'll definitely hurt their chances of survival. Either you can give one guy the water and he'll for sure live. You'll give the other guy the water. The other guy will have nothing. He'll for sure die. Or you'll split the water and now each of them has a 50-50 chance of making it. So what's better? Do you kind of go for the money in the bag and allow one person to certainly live, and you know, too bad for the other guy, and then you have to, then question two becomes, and if that's what you're going to do, how do you decide who lives? You just flip a coin, you know, how do you answer that question? But after that, the other option is, well, maybe it's better to give each of them a fighting chance and then kind of put the ball back in God's court, that instead of you being the one who has to make the decision, which is really like, you know, a decision that's for God of who lives and who dies, is it better to give each of them a fighting chance, give each of them either half the canteen of water, half of a ventilator, whatever it is, and then ultimately God will be the one who makes that decision of what's supposed to happen. That's kind of the way.
That's the dilemma, okay.
Yeah. So there's an interesting case that comes up in the book of Samuel, where it's talking about King David, and there were many rebellions against King David. He had a very difficult life, lots of rebellions against him. And one rebellion, one of the people who rebels against him is someone by the name of Sheva, the son of Bichri. Okay, he's kind of an enigmatic character. What exactly the agenda is, fine, that's for a different time. But the point is that ultimately Sheva is on the run. David's general Yoav is chasing after him. He gets word that Sheva is hiding out in a certain city. He lays siege to the city and he tells them, either I'm going to kill all, he pretty much tells them, hand him over or else. And the Talmud records that there was, and the Talmud praises this woman who does it based on, you know, it's based on interpretation of a verse. But the Talmud says that there's this one woman who pretty much comes with the whole plan of how to hand him over. She ultimately ends up killing him herself and handing his head over. But okay, but the point is, that she apparently felt that it was appropriate to, and the Talmud praises her actions for killing this one guy, this one rebel in the city, to save everyone, right? So the question is, well, wait a second, what happened to the, we just said that if there's a group of bandits surrounding your caravan and they say, either hand over one of them or we'll kill all of you, the Nazis come, like Howard said, and say, either choose one of your own to hand over, we'll kill all of you, then absolutely forbidden, let them do what they're going to do. But all of a sudden, you've got this this woman who is killing off the rebel Sheva ben Bichri to save everyone else in the city. And the Talmud says it was a great thing to do. So the question is, what's the difference? Why is that case, the case of killing the rebel, where to save the whole city, different than the first case? Any thoughts?
He was the one physically putting them in danger, not by anything that he, and unlike the arbitrary thing where the Goyim are coming and saying, just give us somebody. He is the one who actively put them in this situation and in danger, perhaps.
Okay, so that's one possibility, which the...
So he comes under a rotate.
That Thomas says that in essence, you know, the Talmud says it slightly differently, but pretty much that he was guilty. He was doing something. He himself was rebelling against the king. That was a criminal activity. He came and put himself in the city. He was clearly the one who was doing something wrong. That's option. That's one possibility. Any other thoughts? So a second option, which the Talmud mentions, is that, well, they're not telling you, you make the choice. There, they are saying specifically, we want him. They're naming, calling him out by name. So even if perhaps, let's say, perhaps even if he wasn't guilty, the fact that it's not just, you're not the one who's playing God. You're not the one who's saying, it's not like the bandits are coming and saying, hand us someone. And now you're deciding which person is most guilty. It's they're coming and saying, we want him. And the fact that they've already set their sights on him kind of makes it, you're stepping back. They're going to kill him either way. They clearly have it out for him. So either you can hand him over right now, or you can say no, they'll come in, they'll kill 20 other people, and they're going to make sure to kill him also. So once they clearly have it out for him, then there is room to argue that, they clearly have it out for him, and they've made the choice, you're not playing God, and that's that. So that's two possibilities in the Talmud. So now that has many, those two options as to why that's okay, have many possible ramifications, practical ramifications. I just want to mention one or two of them. So there was a very, very famous case in 1977. There was an Orthodox family in Lakewood, New Jersey, who gave birth to twin girls. So what made these, that's not terribly unusual, what made this case most unusual was that the twin girls were Siamese twins. So I know it's a very tragic case. The Siamese twins were joined kind of from pretty much at the torso. They shared a heart. It was a six-chambered heart that they were sharing. And there was clear that both of they took so the family took the kids to a children's hospital in Philadelphia, one of the best children's hospitals in the world. The chief surgeon there was a man by the name of C. Everett Koop, who went on to become the Surgeon General in the United States under Reagan. So the question was,
most famous Surgeon General ever.
What's that?
Most famous Surgeon General ever.
Most famous Surgeon General ever. Okay, I'll take your word for it. I do not have the longevity to make that assertion, but I don't know how many people here know who the Surgeon General is today. So.
Yeah, he's been on TV.
I've seen him on TV a lot. Yeah,
I don't know who Fauci is.
Who made his name for stopping smoking?
But anyways, so C. Everett Koop was the chief surgeon at Children's Hospital back then, and the question was what he determined. It wasn't so simple. He pretty much determined that one of the twins was for sure not going to live. I believe it was the right side. The twin on the right side could not live no matter what. It would not be feasible to save that twin. He could also determine it would not be feasible for them to live together. The only option was, in essence, to kill the right-hand twin, transfer the heart into the left-hand twin, and then kind of go from there. So obviously, this was a very serious legal question. He pretty much secured permission that he would be legally exempt for doing anything. He couldn't be held accountable. But the question was, ethically, morally, would it be the right thing to do? So C. Everett Koop famously, when he was asked he was challenged by some of the other doctors, what are you debating about so long? Just make a decision. He said that he did not feel worthy to make the ethical decision himself. He said, there's an old rabbi on the Lower East Side. He's a very saintly man. The question has been referred to him. We're going to wait for his answer. And what he tells us to do, that's what we're going to do. And Dr. Aside, was not a Jewish person, but he had a great respect for this old rabbi on the Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. That old rabbi on the Lower East Side was none other than the very famous Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, one of the most prominent halachic authorities of the 20th century. So Rabbi Feinstein was referred this question. He took it very, very seriously. He spent days in discussion with his son-in-law, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler, and who's like an expert in Jewish ethics. And he reportedly, he even fasted before he answered the question because he felt it was just such a difficult question that to decide literally to murder one of the twins to save the other one. But maybe it's better just let nature take its course, and if they both die, so be it. But do you ever have the right to literally go ahead and commit an act of murder to save another person? So
absolutely. You abort a child to save the mother's life.
That's in it. So Howard is referencing a very important law, which is that it's something which I think is accepted in contemporary medical ethics, and it's something which is very much accepted in Jewish ethics, which is that if you have a child which is threatening the mother's life, that the pregnancy is threatening the mother's life, childbirth is threatening the mother's life, then Jewish law tells us we absolutely have the right to kill the child to save the mother. But this case is a little bit different because of the following. The law, at least from a Jewish perspective, I don't know if this is true I don't think this is true in contemporary American medical ethics, but from a Jewish perspective, once that child emerges, pretty much once he pokes his head out of his mother, and we kind of view him as a full-fledged human being, you do not have the right, you're in the midst of childbirth, right? The child's halfway out. And it's clear, if the birthing procedure continues normally, he's gonna kill the mother. According to Jewish ethics, at that point in time, we don't have the right to make the decision. Once he's a human being, so to speak, a full human being, he's all the way out, you cannot make that choice to just say, why is he, at that point in time, why is he any different than the mother? It's true that they can't both live, but what gives us the right to make that choice? So that being said, do we have the right, we assume, both these are two independent human beings, they're conjoined. Do we have the right to make that choice of who to live and who lives and who dies? Any thoughts?
And family members get involved in that kind of thing?
And so the family members, I believe, the parents were the ones who initially directed the question to Rabbi Feinstein. I don't know if Dr. Koop was familiar with Rabbi Feinstein initially. They were the ones who initially wanted to wait for Rabbi Feinstein's response. And Dr. Koop, I guess, was agreed with them fully. And when other doctors were pressuring him or kind of to just make a decision, that was when he said that he agreed that Rabbi Feinstein was the one who had to make this decision. So the parents didn't have kind of just wanted to go along with what Rabbi Feinstein wanted to do as well.
But you still come back to a triage situation. Mm-hmm. If both are going to die most likely, then you save the one who has the best chance of living.
Do you have the right to do that if you're actually killing someone else?
I'm not sure if right is the word I would use. Do I have the obligation to make that choice?
Should I stand by and watch
both of them die?
Is it ethically correct? Is it morally correct? Or is that what God wants us to do? Does God want us to make the decision to actually physically kill one human being to save another?
When God texts me and tells me what to do, then I'll wait for his decision. Until then, I'm going to have to use the seichel he gave me.
Okay.
Except that what we do know is this is not analogous to the triage that you're talking about. And the triage, it's simply who do I save first, and what we call a sheval taset, don't do anything, as opposed to here, you're physically going to have to kill someone to save the other. So it's not necessarily the same. It's not analogous. How you decide is a separate story, but it's not analogous to the triage in that you have to physically do an action to harm the other one.
Well, it's analogous if they're both not going to survive, and you have to choose the one that has the best chance to survive.
So,
but choosing that one is going to kill. You have to kill the other one to make that choice.
Right. If they're both going to die,
okay, but one survives.
So ultimately, what ended up happening was Rabbi Feinstein decided, and he never published his rationale, but he decided that it would be acceptable to go ahead with the surgery. Tragically, what ended up happening was that a few days after the surgery, the surviving twin died of hepatitis that it was got from a blood transfusion in the hospital. So that was kind of a really sad ending to the story. But they did go ahead with the surgery, and inherently the surgery, the Dr. Krupp was correct in that the surgery would be able to be done. Once they went and they saw that he was clearly correct that they could only have saved one of the two twins, and the surgery was done, and but sadly both children ended up dying. Ultimately ended up dying. The question is what the rationale was. So one rationale, right? Again, Rabbi Feinstein never made his rationale clear in a written source. But the most compelling presentation of his rationale that I'm aware of, that at least from what I saw, is that some claim that in essence there are really two factors here. One factor is, do we look at look at the second twin as being of, and this is a very difficult thing to say, but just like we look at a fetus before it has emerged, vis-a-vis the mother, as being, I guess, a less significant life form, that you have a fetus which could eventually become a full human being, right? But we say, so long as it doesn't actually come, hasn't come out yet, then vis-a-vis the mother, it's kind of like second tier and has the right to be killed. Do you in essence have the right to make that decision here, that one twin is a fully viable life form, the other one is not? Does that give us, and some argue that Rabbi Feinstein may have asserted that we view the second twin, the twin which cannot survive, as being a lower tier life form, so to speak, than the other twins. So that's, I mean, it's a very, it's a hard thing to say, and there's no clear precedent, at least in the Talmud, for saying such a thing, that when you have two living entities, to say, well, one of them is a quote unquote lower form of life because it cannot survive. But some understand that was really Rabbi Feinstein's thought process, and that's what allowed him to make his decision. Now, a second, interesting case to talk about is the following. Everyone here certainly remembers September 11th very well, and we know that, of course, that there were two planes which are hijacked and hit the Twin Towers, a third plane which is hijacked and flown into the Pentagon, and then you have the fourth plane which is taken down by the passengers somewhere out in the middle of Pennsylvania, right? So now there is a conspiracy theory, I don't think there's any evidence at all that the plane was not taken down by the passengers at all. It was all just, it was actually shot down by the American Air Force, and they made up the whole thing with Let's Roll and the story just to inspire the public, but it was all completely fabricated, and the Americans actually shot down the plane because they knew it was headed for the White House, and it would just be kill more people and be such a blow to national morale that they couldn't do it. So I don't believe that. But let's take it for granted. Let's imagine though that's the choice, even if that's not what happened, then I think it's probably reasonable that was going through people's minds in the Air Force. Meaning, let's take it for granted that the passengers actually brought the plane down. Would the Air Force have let it been flown into? It's one must imagine that before the plane actually was taken down, that the people sitting comfortably somewhere out in, I don't know, Northern Virginia or wherever, are thinking, well, if there's a fourth plane, what can we do to make sure that it's not going to be flown into anything? So do you have the right to do that? Do you have the right? Is that right, wrong, optional, good, bad, for to shoot down a plane where this is not the equivalent of shooting someone in the foot. You're going to blow this plane out of the sky. Everyone is going to die. Do you have the right to do that to save the lot? Those people are going to, by saying, in essence, those people are going to die anyways, and we're going to save way more people on the ground. Do you have the right to make that, to do that type of math?
You like using that word right. Okay. In this particular case, you're not talking about right. You're talking about obligation.
An obligation. Do you have an obligation to do that?
Yes. As a military member, you have the obligation to protect the United States. I was the second button on a nuclear weapon. And the captain asked me, could you in clear conscience push the button to launch the nuclear weapon? And I said, absolutely not. And he said, well, why are you telling me no? You don't have to take you off your position. I said, you didn't ask me if I would do it. You asked me if I could do it with a clear conscience. And the bottom line is a military member is in a very different situation than a civilian because I follow my orders and I don't get to make decisions. So there's
let's reframe the question. I'm not talking about if you're the Air Force member flying the fighter jet that's actually going to shoot the plane down. If you are the Air Force, the chief of staff
who's still military,
should he make that decision to have the plane shot down?
He has to follow the orders of the commander in chief.
What should the commander? So that's, you're just kicking the can.
Commander in chief
say.
So you're saying that does the president have the right to make that order?
Yes.
Okay. I would say yes. His job as the commander in chief is also military to protect and defend the United States. So if there's an attack coming to the United States on the United States, which the White House or any of these other buildings would represent. It's his job. Yeah, they brought it. The plane did go down in a desolate area, in an unpopulated area. So those people would have died anyway if they had crashed into their target.
Okay.
So I have a documentary I just watched that during World War II, the United States had the option of bombing Auschwitz. And the thought was, yeah, we'll be killing the people that are there now, but it'll stop the future deaths.
Okay,
and so they decided not to do it.
Same type of question.
Hmm?
So I guess the way I would frame the question is we mentioned a few minutes ago that we have these two options in the Talmud as to why it was okay to kill this rebellious leader, Sheva. And the two options were, well, either option number one might be that he himself was guilty. Option number two was, in essence, they're looking for him, they've requested him, he's for sure going to die, so we don't lose anything by handing him over. So you could kind of, those two rationales kind of come back into play here. If the justification for killing someone is, well, they're looking for him, he's for sure going to die anyways, one could argue, which is in essence what Howard is arguing, everyone on this plane is going to die anyways. In the case of Auschwitz, it might be a little different because you don't know for sure that everyone there is going to die anyways. But certainly on this plane, everyone's going to die anyways. That we know. So one could argue that in essence is comparable in as much as we don't have a right to go to say, well, we want to save 100 people, so we'll kill 10 people over here randomly. But where we know these people on the plane are going to die anyways, and it's just a question of, are we going to kill them now and save other people or not? One could argue that would be okay. But if the rationale for killing people, for handing over this rebel leader is, well, he himself was guilty, he brought it upon himself, he was the one who led the rebellion and ran into the city and led to the siege in the first place, well, these people on the plane obviously were by no means culpable in the fact that their plane is hijacked by Islamic extremists and that this is all happening. So, it could hinge on that question a little bit, which is why the way I would see it, it's really not so clear at all that you have the right, the obligation to shoot that plane down.
Let me aggravate you just a little bit further. In the case that you're presenting, if they say, if you don't give us this guy, we're going to kill all these other people, and that person says, I'll step forward, is he allowed to step forward? Because then he's committing suicide.
So that is a point which many say would certainly be allowable and maybe even honorable, that if a person says, I want to make that choice to give up my life to save so many others, that's okay. The problem is when I make a choice that, well, you'll give up your life to save other people. That's where you run into problems. And it's a very, that's where we have the issues that we're talking about.
But how is that different than giving my water to somebody else? I'm still committing suicide to save someone else.
So in the water case, the question was really, do you have the right to hold on to drink the water yourself. If you so choose.
If I give it up, it's different.
Okay. Right. So then that would be so fine. So all with all that background in mind, let's get to triage. So you have people coming into the hospital, right? And you have, let's talk about a case which unfortunately is happening in certainly already in countries like Italy, right? You have, and oh God should help us, that's not going to be happening here in the near future, but you have two coronavirus patients coming to the hospital at the same time, right? One of them is an older person in a very aggravated case, and you could give them a ventilator. And let's make it simple. There's one ventilator available in the hospital. Two people coming in. One of them is someone who you think has a pretty good chance at survival. One of them is a person who has a very limited chance at survival. There, I think we would all agree that in such a clear-cut case, right now there is only one ventilator available. Two people pretty much pulling up at the same time. One of them has a good chance of survival. One of them doesn't. There, I think it's pretty straightforward that, well, of course you should practice triage and give it to the person who has a better chance of survival. That I think is a pretty, I think everyone would agree that that's a pretty clear cut case. So, okay. So where things get more complicated, where I think there could be a lot more complication is, I guess, let's say let's talk about a slightly different case. Let's say you've got one ventilator in the hospital available. One patient comes. The person is already advanced in years. They've got a relatively a pretty severe case. You don't think it's going to help that. The doctor who's admitting them envisions that what's going to happen is they're going to stick this guy in a ventilator for a week or two, and then he's going to end up dying. In the meantime, there could very well be, you know, again, we're talking about it in a situation where there are many other patients coming in. You would envision logically that in the near future, another patient may come in who would benefit from the ventilator much more. So what do you do now? Do you have the right to make that choice now and to say, well, there's no one else who actually needs it, but we're just going to stick you in some room and give you, I guess, a little bit of a, you know, we'll do the best we can, but we're not going to dedicate resources to you now because we anticipate that the resources can be better used in the future. What happens then?
If it's me and I'm going to die anyway, I would say make me comfortable and save the resource.
Yeah, save the resource, yeah.
Save the resources. Okay. This question was posed to, among others, someone named Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who was a very prominent authority in Israel, who, as it so happened, lived across the street from Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem. So kind of by virtue of his proximity, he became extremely involved in a lot of the medical issues in Shaarei Tzedek. And Shaarei Tzedek is a hospital where they try doing things in accordance with Jewish law. So he was asked this question. He concurred with Al and Howard and said, yeah, that would be, that's the right thing to do. Because, and you know, we're not talking about where there's some, maybe you never know, it could be someone else will come in, but in a situation where it is in fact likely that someone else will be coming who can benefit from the resources much more than the first person, then it would be appropriate, it would be a good thing to do to spend the resources on someone who could benefit from it much more. Okay, so now let's make the question a little bit harder, which is, the person came in and you didn't realize that the ventilators were going to be scarce, you weren't thinking, you already have them on the ventilator, or any general case, you have something going on, you have one person who comes into the emergency room and you take him back, you have him, he's being attended to, and then you have another case who comes in and you feel that the second case coming in has a better chance of survival, but you're already dealing with the first guy. You already have doctors and nurses attending to him. You already have him on a machine. Whatever it is, you're already dedicating resources to one person. You're in the midst of dealing with him. At that point in time, do you have the right to say, well, you know, we're sorry, but we're going to unhook you. We're sorry, but we can't, you know, we'll, you know, here's a cup of Coke, but we're going to go deal with the other person. We don't have, once you have already made the choice, you're already involved. At that point in time, do you have the right to back off? Or a different case, which is talked about in, which, you know, I saw one source talk about, also a theoretical case built off a real case. Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein talks about a case where after a terrorist attack in Israel, where a doctor sees a young boy who is bleeding profusely from the neck, and the doctor rushes over and he is able, literally with his bare hands, he puts his fingers on the wounds and he's able to slow the bleeding. Thank God he saves the kid's life, right? But what would have happened if Rabbi Zilberstein poses a theoretical question of, let's change it up a little bit. Let's say that he has his hands on the wound, right? And he realizes it's not helping that much. The kid's, you know, his skin color doesn't look good. Things don't look like they're heading in the right direction. And instead, he sees some other people who are moderately wounded. He figures, I can go and save. It's a group of people. The amount of time and effort I'm sitting here literally tied down to this kid, but because I'm holding my hand over his wound, you know, I could just let go, but whatever happens will happen. Maybe some other paramedics will get here. Maybe it'll be okay. Maybe God will help him. But in the meantime, there are two or three other people who are more moderately wounded. I could be dealing with all of them, save all of them. And if I don't deal with them, they might die. But you know, I think they've got a better chance than this kid. So it's a similar type of a question of, do you have the right to leave active involvement, unhook someone, etc., from what they're on now because you feel like someone else has better odds? That I think because you know, I think we can appreciate that the question is a much more difficult question. That on, you know, Howard is shrugging at me.
I have a very different perspective, okay? I don't worry so much about what a book is gonna tell me what to do. My perspective on life is I've learned from that book on who I want to be. Once that decision is made, as I come into each decision in my life, I have to make a decision based on what I can live with. So in that particular case that you're talking about, can I live with letting this person go to save others? Can I be okay with myself? Does it feel right for me to do that?
Okay, so
now, I'm not going to look at a book written 2,000 years ago to make that decision for
me. Okay, so what feels right to you? What is it? What feels right? Is it the right thing to do to let the kid die, or is it the right thing to do to go save two or three other people? Is it the right thing to do to let the old person stay on the ventilator and you don't really know if it's going to help them? Or is it the right thing to do to unhook them and get someone else on who has a much better chance of survival?
Mm-hmm. And again, the question is, you said the kid was fading and that me holding that wound is not helping him. So to me, that means the person's going to die anyway. Again, the other case you talked about was the person's going to die anyway. So in essence, what we're talking about is, am I saving a life or prolonging a life till it dies?
I would say that you would want to, once you start the procedure and you've gone down that road and you've made a decision, then you stick with the ramification, even if something else comes along better.
And that's a personal morality or a personal ethics choice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Each question is going to be personal based on my situation and who I am as a person. It's not going to be based on what somebody 2,000 years ago told me to do.
I mean, that's, I guess, a whole separate discussion.
Yes, it is. But then you keep telling me to come to your class. You know who I am.
Once you start a procedure like that, you can't stop doing the procedure once you've made the recognition of doing it, going ahead and doing it.
And what would you say, Al, if there's a question of saving multiple people? Meaning, it's not one for one, but let's say I've started the procedure. Let's say, you know, they have this ventilator splitting technique. Let's assume it works for a minute. I'm not sure if they have any real, you know, indication of how successful it can be. Let's say for argument's sake, it can work. So you've got one person on the ventilator. The only way they're going to survive is if they're the whole, even have a chance if the ventilator is completely dedicated to that. The other option is taking it off. You've got two people. You think that you can save both of them with the ventilator splitting technique. So is it still the same? Would you still make the same argument that, you know, once you're on, you're on?
Well, that might be a technological question also, you know, of right, what's...
Okay, that's a fair point. I mean, it's a lot of this, especially with these, you know, if you're doing some experimental technique, you don't know for sure what's going to happen. But in theory, let's say you're as far as you can tell, you'll be able to, let's make it a one for two. Either try working with the one person you're still with, you don't think he's got great chances, or work with two people you think you have a much better chance with. Does that change the equation?
I'd probably still lean towards going with the first person and seeing how that evolves and, you know, how the case progresses and then go on to the next person, I think.
Okay. So I guess we have some, I guess, different feelings on this. You know, by way of comparison, I guess, with our own thoughts. So there, interestingly enough, there does seem to be some dissent amongst more contemporary halakhic thinkers about what would be done here. For example, Rabbi Zilberstein, who I mentioned before, in the case of where, you know, you've got this one kid who's bleeding, you're working on him, you're not sure if you're going to be able to save him, or you can go and most probably save two or three other people. There, I think he, in his mind, the way it seems to me, the way he's presenting it, what makes the difference is the numbers. That he seems to kind of feel that working with one person, you know, if it's just a one for one, then it's a harder thing to do. But if you have that kind of that added point of, I can, you know, once you're working with one person, maybe you should stick with it. But if you can then go and triage into working with multiple people, then I think he seems to give precedence to maybe saving the masses. On the other hand, Rabbi Feinstein, who we mentioned earlier, seemed to be, at least from what's recorded, he seemed to be of the opinion that more closely to, I guess, what Al is presenting, that that kind of once one person is being dealt with, he's in the room, the way he has an interest in presentation of it, which is that one guy wouldn't have to give up his life to save the other guy, right? If you ask the guy on the ventilator, you know, it's your choice. You know, you decide. Do you think it's the right? Do you want to give up your life to save the other person, to save someone else? He doesn't have to. It's not his obligation. Like we've discussed previously, a person's right to self-preservation comes first. If he says yes, you know, I want to do a noble thing, I'm probably not going to make it. Don't waste your time on me. Do triage. Save someone else. He has the right to do that. But from a, you know, from a purely obligational standpoint, he has no obligation to say, stop working on me. And so Rabbi Feinstein kind of presented as, well, if he doesn't have an obligation to do it himself, then we have no right to stop helping him. That's kind of the way he presents it. I guess there can be now one other thing to take into consideration, which is that do things change, I guess, when we know we're in what we'd call a war mode, a crisis mode, in which clearly we are in today, where it's not just a question of two people showing up at the hospital. You know, there was a bad car crash and two people show up and now it's a question of what to do. But there's a question of, this is a prolonged situation. We know that we're in this for the long haul. Does that change anything? Does that change our perspective of, we know that this is not just a, you know, a one-time flash in the pan type of crazy situation where all of a sudden we've got scarce resources, but now we know this is going to be an ongoing issue, and we need to come up with a manageable plan to make things work long term. So do we have the right? You know, I think it was mentioned much earlier in the class that maybe about a long term perspective. So does a long term
original question with Cuomo and Trump.
What's that? Yeah, exactly.
That was your original.
Going back to Cuomo and Trump, I mean, does the fact that there's a long-term issue change things here? Does the fact that allow us to say, let's not focus on, you know, a one ventilator, let's not deal with this on a ventilator by ventilator, case by case basis. Instead, does that give us the right to have kind of a bigger perspective here about who we should be putting our effort into? And I guess maybe something to, you know, we can put it this way. You've got two people who show up in the hospital. They both need the ventilator. You're pretty sure both of them can survive. One of them could need the ventilator for a lot, for a shorter period of time. Does that make a difference? Does that, do we have the right to say, well, not only are we know you could live if we gave it to you. It's not a question of, well, you're not going to make it, so we're not interested. But it's, well, if we give it to you, then you're going to live. But who knows, it, in the meantime, two or three other people might die because two or three other moderate cases might be able to be saved. So do we have the right to make a book? In a sense, I think that's, you know, maybe the hardest question we've talked, the way I see it, the hardest question we talked about, or a very, it's a very difficult question where it's not, should we kind of, you know, in the other case, you can kind of say, you know, you're just, you know, beating down the wrong path. This guy's already dying. He's, you're going to lose him anyways. You have a guy here. He's going to, you could save him. That's not your question, but it's but you know, do we say, well, you know, other, it's too many people going to, the cost is too high.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't Jewish law differentiate between the value of a Jewish soul and a non-Jewish soul, and between a man and a woman? Aren't they? Don't they have different values in Jewish law?
So Howard is pointing out something, which is I wasn't going to talk about because it's not terribly relevant in a practical sense. But Howard is correct. There is an explicit source which states that if you are faced with the choice of saving a man or a woman. Or there are other degradations. There are other gradations involved. I see that Mr. Cohen is with us. If it's a question of a Kohen or Yisrael, you save the Kohen. Those values are stated explicitly in the Mishnah. But case in point, almost every halachic authority says that we don't really use those. The reason being, they allege that those I guess triage criteria are only relevant in almost a hypothetical, all things being equal situation, meaning if you have two people who are coming in and their odds at survival are exactly the same, then they, and I guess no other determining criteria, then yes, it may be true that we follow those criteria, but that's, I mean, I think we all know that that's not, there are generally speaking, maybe many other criteria as well. And therefore the many, many halachic authorities allege that those criteria are kind of the, I guess the criteria of last resort. If in a perfect world, all things being equal, where instead of flipping a coin, follow these, if you're literally at a flipping a coin type of situation, there is no reason, no criteria, no one has a better chance of survival, none of that, then you follow these rules. But in lieu of that, then you always would, these other criteria, such as determining who has a better chance of survival, who showed up in the emergency room first, those criteria would take precedence. That seems to be the generally accepted view of most.
But are there any rabbis who really, really would differentiate based on gender? I mean, in a case like that where everything else is equal, I mean, could that possibly happen?
As I said, it's a very, very theoretical case, because I'm sure anyone who's ever, you know, again, we're talking about literally two ambulances show up at the same split second. It's a difficult topic to explain. And, you know, Howard is one who likes to ask difficult questions. So thank you for bringing this up.
I want to remind you, you asked me to come.
I'm glad this was brought up, because it's, you know, in the spirit of intellectual honesty, the source does exist. And like Al is saying, it's a hard idea for us to wrap our heads around. Could it be true? I'll just give you the rationale. The rationale given for why a man would take precedence over a woman is that men are, strictly speaking, obligated in more mitzvot, are obligated in more commandments than women are. So that is the rationale which is given. Now, one could, that being said, it's still hard for us to fathom why that would be true. But I mean, let me remind you, or let me inform you, for those who aren't aware of this, men are, in the traditional Jewish prayer service, men make a blessing every day. Thank you, God, for making me a man, i.e. for not making me a woman. And which, once again, is, in our age of, I mean, I guess where, I wouldn't even call it gender equality, so 1980. This is, in our day and age, it's hard for us to understand why that would be true, but the same rationale is presented there, that men are, technically speaking, obligated in more mitzvot than women are, That's a fact. Women are exempt from any mitzvot, and because of that, we view it as, from our perspective as men or as human beings, we see there's a certain, I guess, value, I would call it, in the fact that we have more commandments. But again, I'm not denying the fact that it's a hard thing for us to wrap our heads around.
You're forgetting that the reason we say Shelo Asani Yisha is not because we have more commandments, but because the commandments that a woman has to follow are more important than harder, which would make them more important because they create the Jewish home.
So
from what you're saying, we have to say that the woman's life is more important, not the man.
What you just said, I guess, is a theory. Let's just differentiate between theory and fact. That is, the facts are, we make the blessing, thank you God for making me a woman. You're presenting a theory that the reason why that blessing was ordained as such was because women's commandments are more difficult. I mean, that's a theory. May not be true.
If a rabbi taught it to me, it's a theory? Wait a minute now. We have to follow the rabbanim. So it's not a theory. It's a teaching. It depends on what age we live in. In the age it was written, men were in charge, so don't question me. And then women started to say, wait a minute. Why are you saying you don't want to be a woman? That's discriminatory. You're diminishing me. So they came up with the excuse, well, wait a minute, that's because women have to work harder. Now you're changing that. No,
I mean,
nice that things can change.
So at the very least, these facts are on the ground, and it's it is a difficult, as Alice pointed out, it is hard to imagine that even in a theoretical sense, we would use that as a decision criteria, but I mean, it is there. And unfortunately, I don't feel like I have a, I think that is the typical explanation, that's why men have presence. I don't really have a better way of explaining that. That's
actually, in most cultures, women are the ones that are saved because you only need one man to repopulate. But one woman can only be,
I don't know if that's really, I mean,
why it's women and children first.
I mean, I always assume that it's women and children first as a matter of pure chivalry. You know, if you're on the Titanic, you have the boats are sinking, you have a 50-year-old woman and a 50-year-old man. Neither of them are planning on reproducing again. It would be completely uncivilized by Western values for the man to get on the boat while the woman is standing on the deck. So I don't know, maybe it originates with a sentiment about reproduction and preserving the species. I think that it's just become a social, at least 100 years ago when the Titanic sank, I think it was just accepted chivalrous practice and not anything, not any real specific motivation. I just want to mention one more potential criteria, and then I'll mention two more ideas briefly, and then I will let everyone go. The hour is getting late. So two more things I want to mention in terms of potential criteria. One possibility is, are people held accountable for getting themselves and digging themselves into this hole? Now, so let's talk about a new situation. Two people, once again, two coronavirus patients coming in to the intensive care unit, both in very bad shape. One of them, let's say, one of them if we put him on a ventilator, he's got a 75% chance of survival. One's got a 70% of survival, right? So far we've been saying better chances of survival, let him do it, right? Let's change things a little bit now. Let's say that the one with the 75% chance of survival is younger. He inherently should have been healthier, but he's been a smoker for the past 25 years. And because of that, he's having a problem in the first place. Had he not been smoking, he would have been a healthy 45-year-old and he'd be just fine. So in essence, the reason why he's in such an acute respiratory situation in the first place is because of the damage he himself did to his lungs. So do we say that, in Kentucky, I think I saw that someone held a coronavirus party where people were intentionally trying to contaminate, to infect themselves, to just get it over with. Let's say someone from one of those parties shows up in the ICU, right? And now it's a question. So do you say, in essence, you did this to yourself? And when you did this to yourself, does that, in essence, push you to the back of the triage line, even if all things being equal, we might have given you precedence? Should that play a role?
By medical law, it does push you to the back of the line.
Yeah.
By medical law, if someone is a smoker, they will be pushed to the back of the line. Is that
it would go under the same as a transplant? If you have caused yourself self harm, it would push you to the back of the list over somebody who has not.
Interesting.
I think that's true.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, here let's point out this is a little bit different than the trans. Meaning, we're not talking about if you have an alcoholic who's coming in for a liver transplant. There's there's a clear causation. The reason why he needs a liver transplant is because he's an alcoholic, right? This person does not need to be put on a ventilator because they were smoking. They need to be put on a ventilator because they had coronavirus. Things are much worse because they were a smoker. So I don't know, would a medical law apply to this situation even? I mean, I think that this might be a little bit different than the transplant situation.
Well, I know in the transplant situation that sclerotic liver would cause you to be pushed to the back of the line because you'd have to be sober for a period of time.
This is a little bit different here. You know, the person did not or didn't really didn't necessarily do themselves in the same exact way.
Actually, they would have because the sclerotic liver would cause your immune system to be compromised.
Okay.
So there is some effect.
Okay. So I wonder if in Jewish thinking we would apply that same criteria. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a question of, you know, we don't view the person as being fundamentally wicked by virtue of the fact that they're an alcoholic. And I mean, once that's not the case, I'm not sure if we would, unless we have reason to believe that the person is just going to kill themselves off again, that, you know, for example, when we talk about the transplant list, we think, well, if we give you the liver, but you're still your alcoholism hasn't been dealt with and you're just going to do it again, that might be a separate story. But let's assume that the person's been in recovery for several years. We think that it's not a recurring problem. I'm not sure in Jewish thought, I mean, we might kind of say, you know, okay, certainly if we view the person as being penitent and having repented, but even in lieu of that, I'm not sure if we would hold it against the person to the extent that we'd put their life on the line. The final thing I want to mention with this we'll conclude is, does the government in Judaism, there's the ideal form of government is a kingdom, there's a king of Israel, right? Fine. The king has unique privileges. The king can make decisions which impact the country in a way that no one else can do it. Fine. So the question is, and the king can even make decisions which might even impact people's lives. So does a government have the right to do the same thing? Does a government have, and this is a question, I don't have an answer to this question, but does a government have, in essence, have the right to say, well, listen, you know, by all other ethical considerations, like we should pull out all the stops, save as many people as we can right now, use up all the ventilators. If there are people who are coming in who are dying right now, then of course we should save their life. But if we did that, then in 2 weeks, then the country is going to, the state is going to descend into a complete panic mode when everyone knows that there's not a single ventilator left. And anyone who is facing serious respiratory issues is going to be left for the dead. Meaning, so.
Triage.
Do we have the right to say, I mean, let's say we're at a situation now where we know we have 1,000 people who need ventilators right now, but if we use up every single ventilator and in 2 weeks there are going to be barely any left, then the state's going to be, the country is going to descend into a state of panic. If people just know that that's where we're at, that there's really nothing we can do anymore, do we have the right to say, in essence, let's almost supersede normal triage considerations and say, we have ventilators to save you sitting in a warehouse somewhere, but we'd rather not do it now because we believe it'll be better for maintaining calm, maintaining a sense of, we got this, we're handling the epidemic, and we still have some ammunition, kind of spreading things out a little bit, as opposed to pulling out all the stops now and then not having anything left in the future. And then who knows what's going to be. So is that something that we would ever take into consideration?
I think you might be focusing on the wrong thing that's going to cause panic. The food shortages are going to cause more panic because it's already happening. There are groceries that just can't be gotten. And I think that that's going to cause more panic than the ventilators, because it's more, how should I put it? It's a more of a common situation, because everybody suffers from a food shortage, whereas only the people in the hospitals will suffer from the ventilator situation.
So do you mean to say that since the panic is going to happen one way or the other?
I think that it could get rough if the best, how do I put it? If people's good natures don't come forward, then things could get rough. I mean, it's happened before. It's not the first time this has happened. We've had many pandemics across history. This is not the first one in the United States, even. The Spanish flu wiped out millions of people. And what happens is that it's happened already now. It's like somebody's afraid they won't be able to wipe their tuchus, so they had to take all the toilet paper, not just enough for their family. They had to take enough for the whole block and then not share it. So you're already seeing the negative nature of humanity causing a problem. And I think that's more of an issue. And to be honest with you, I think the ventilators is a way of distracting the population from considering that.
Okay.
And something else I want to mention. A king and a government come by their power for the same reason. They own all the guns.
Okay,
the king owns the army, the government owns the army. That's what gives them their power. So they come from the same place. It doesn't really matter what you call them. They still take their right by power.
Wow. Okay, thank you very much. That's very
cool. This is a way. I got some thoughts. So I think when we jump into that situation, okay, in 2 weeks or the vandalism.
The hour is kind of late, so I don't want to hold everyone.
Okay.
I think we may have to end class here. So I apologize though. So please, I'm happy to stay on the line for a minute if you want to email me your thoughts or whatever. But I think we're going to end here. It is getting kind of late, but thank you everyone for tuning in. God willing, we'll have one more class next week before Pesach, and then we'll see from there. So, okay.
All right. Good discussion.
Thank you very much, y'all. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Grandpa. Thank you, Paul, Joe, Bruce, Howard, Daddy. Thank you very much all for unnamed way. Thank you very much for tuning in.
Thank you very much.
Keep safe, everybody.
Your toes.
Keep safe.
Stay healthy.
Your toes.